And tonight, I hope we will round out our treatment of Eko Omar. I have no idea how other people experience this, but in the past few weeks, just our meditation on this particular kina, without spreading too far, but just focusing on this and reading it for myself dozens of times, has added a depth to my sense of this whole season that I honestly don't ever remember experiencing before. And perhaps that should be a reminder to us of the extreme concentrated power in so many of the kinos, particularly the works of Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, my patron poet, that perhaps we really do need to dig deeply. Let me just give a very brief introduction for those who may be joining us for the first time, or for those who have had a very hard week and whose memory cells have been washed clean by stress, just to bring everyone to the same page. Mentioned that kinos, the dirges as they're called of Tisha B'Av, are themselves a branch of piyut, and piyut means poetry specifically designed to be used in an act of prayer. Right? The original locus of the kinos was really part of the repetition of the Amidah, culminating in the bracha, which in Palestine, where this entire genre had its genesis, the brachos that we say v'Yerushalayim Ircha and Es Tzemach David were one bracha. So the Shemona Esrei actually was an 18 benediction Shemona Esrei, contrary to popular thinking, and each element, each blessing of the Amidah had its installment with the final climax in that blessing which deals with Jerusalem. Clearly, by the time you get to the bracha of Jerusalem and the redemption which one looks forward to, things reach a fever pitch. Well, what happened was that the water overflowed the bowl, so to speak, and the kinos sort of rose up from this, clearly touching some very sensitive nerve in the Jewish psyche, and then moved the bulk of the kinos after the repetition of the Shemona Esrei, and kinos in a sense became a service unto themselves, and they follow a very specific order. Unfortunately, about 30 years ago, a rabbi came to Riverdale and made a selection from among them. I'm not sure if his successor, the old rabbi who works there now, would make the same selection now, knowing what he knows now. However, the old rabbi is tired, lazy old rabbi, so he sort of sticks with the same selection. So most of the great classics are touched upon. The one which is our focus, has been our focus for these 3 weeks, as I mentioned last time, is actually an extension of a midrashic theme. Now, we know now that the midrash and piyut, in a sense, were in flower at the same time. Their periods overlap. The midrash probably starts a little bit earlier, but the midrash was still the way in which rabbis would preach their homilies from the text of the Torah reading or the readings from the prophets. And while they were doing their thing, the cantors were creating this rich liturgy, which wasn't always the same every week. Rather, it was a liturgy that was evolving. And so in the epicenter of the classical period, great poets were really great chazonim, like Rebbe Elazar HaKalir, late 6th, early 7th century. And so they themselves, in a sense, were not only using Midrash, we now know that they were actually creating Midrash in the context of their liturgical poetry. They were extending. So here we have a perfect example, because in the famous salmon-colored section on the third page, just to remind you, I think I really got the color. I've nailed the color code this time. I'm in the groove. The two midrashic sources will touch on three of the elements that the Paitan develops in this kina, but it sort of sets the direction, and he continues it, extrapolates it, but doesn't just extrapolate in the same groove. He really takes on new kinds of examples and tucks them in between. So just to remind you of the midrashic sources, right? The midrash on Echa, first, where it's quoted in the Yalkut Shimoni, it appears in several places, puzzles over the word Echa, right? Which, of course, Echa is the opening word of the Book of Lamentations. But the Midrash does a kind of a wordplay with it and breaks it down as if it's a kind of a false etymology. Instead of saying Echo, which simply means how shall I bear it, or how has this come to pass, it says Echo. Where is the Ko? And we worked last week and learned the Rashi. I'm not going to go through it all, but we spoke about Ko as something which speaks about God making known to people in a particular time and place what it is that he wants from them, what their goal should be, what the meaning of their lives may be. And so the Midrash already begins with kind of the classic examples, where it says, what does Echo mean? It means, Aye ko shenemar la'avram avinu ko yezaracha. Where is the ko feature? The feature which promised Abraham an infinitely meaningful destiny. Those are all key terms in my opinion, because he had him look at the stars and see their vast number. But he said, Ko yezaracha, these will be your children. As if to say, each and every one will be like a star in the heaven. None will be extra, superfluous, right? So that is the beginning of a destiny-driven people. And then he says, Va'aye ko shenemar l'moshe, ko somar l'beis Yaakov. The second infusion of that precise destiny comes with the revelation at Sinai, with the revelation of the will of God to his people, saying, here is the way a nation of destiny must conduct itself. And that's where you get the whole notion of the chosen people and the Am Segula. That's really what it means. It means a destiny charted, a destiny-charted people. Okay, but then one more element, which further strengthens the force of this word ko, and that is the Midrash, which tells us that ko sivarachu es b'nei Yisrael, the purest blessing that the Torah records, because it is not a blessing which is the product of covenant. If you will, then I will. Right? V'hoyoim shomoa tishmu'u. If you'll listen, then God will give you the rain and the goodies, and a Mercedes Benz will fall down from heaven in front of your house. Take one very subtle bounce and be ready for action. That is all conditional. Birkas Kohanim is no condition. Birkas Kohanim is Kosevarchus B'nei Yisrael. Thus shall you shower blessing on the Jewish people. So that is the third element of this destiny triad. Now, Rabbi Elazar HaKalir is going to expand upon this tripod. Each of these elements is going to appear, but so will many others. And the others are going to be all of interest. Now, pausing for a moment, I hope to reveal to you my finest trick. This just occurred to me today. I'm sorry to say, I should have occurred to me from the beginning. Because thanks to my color-coded chart, which you probably thought was just the silliness of an elderly person who has figured out that you can change colors on the things in your computer. You figure Rosenblatt just finally figured this out. He's been typing away on this for 30 years. He finally found the right button. This is not all there is. I have reproduced the first half of Psalm 74. That's on your first page, right? Now on Psalm, each of the red and the blue phrases, the reason I made them red and blue is to keep them from running into each other. It is not because some were spoken by Republicans and other were spoken by Democrats. I just wanted, this is a political time, everybody's crazy. There are now 694 Republican candidates, and so I don't want everybody to get all nervous. So that's how I did it, in order to keep them separated. However, and how are they used? Each of these little phrases from a perek in Tehillim, which the Radak considers to be David HaMelech's elegy to the Churban, to the destruction of the temple, even though it hadn't been destroyed yet. But you realize I do know enough history to know that with David HaMelech it hadn't been built yet. But to the notion of Churban, you know what I failed to see when I first did this? I failed to see the most important thing. The verses that are not used. Because buried in the verses not used, a little bit like a paper cut, is the key to this entire kina. Why? What are the two complete verses between 1 and 10? There are only two verses which are not excerpted at all in the poem. The first one is verse 2, which says, Zichor adosecha konisa kedem, remember your flock or your congregation which you acquired for yourself in days of old, go'alta shevet nachalasecha, and you redeemed. In other words, they were in trouble and you redeemed them. How did God acquire us? He went into Egypt and he bought a nation on sale, because no one else would have wanted us in those conditions. It was a good deal. So, and we assume God is Jewish, so that's the way it goes. And then he goes, Hartzion ze shochantovo. And then with this acquired nation, you came and dwelt on Zion. That is the origin of the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash is the place where God, who has just redeemed His people, has enshrined His presence among that people. You have right there the whole process from Exodus to Solomon's temple in one verse. Now take the next verse, which the paper cut has left, which is verse 9. What is verse 9 bemoan? And all in between, the reds and the blues, are various aspects of Churban, which will be checkered through our kina. But verse 9 says, Oso senu lo ro'inu ein od navi. We have no signs. We have no road markers. Because we have no prophets. V'lo itanu yodea ad ma. And there is no one among us who can tell us, who knows how long it will be until we'll be redeemed. for those of you who were here last week, see, co doesn't mean... See, that's a very interesting thing. You never realize the entire Jewish people is codependent. That is probably going to be the worst pun you're going to hear this entire year. I just thought I would get it out of the way early. But co does not necessarily mean that we will enjoy always an easy history. However, co is the sense that even when things are difficult, such as when God is redeeming us from Egypt, even in difficulty, there will be a sense that there is a process which is being controlled by some divine force and being, as it were, announced or articulated by the voice of prophets. The galus, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, as it is experienced by Kalir, 500 years and nothing, 500 years after the Churban, and there's no sense of what's really happening. I told you that it is a time of great political instability. The land of Israel has become a kind of a backwater through which Christians and Persians and Arabs traipse back and forth, turning it into a football. Right? And this is as we mentioned, there within decades, they went from thinking Hashem was sending the Mashiach to build the third temple to feeling that they were wrenched off the land in such a violent way by the cruel taxes and the discriminatory laws of the Code of Justinian, that they didn't know whether they were in a process of redemption or a process of destruction. And so when he says, a co, where is the co in our lives? And realizes that they are living, because you see, we're very impressed. We're very impressed because why? Because at the same time, there was a shul on Shabbos morning. Must have been incredible. Like, I don't think anyone went out for a Kiddush club because you'd miss something. It was like so exciting because remember, as I told you last time, the guy who got up to give the drasha was creating midrash. The guy who davened was creating piyut. And while they were reading the Torah, the guy in between the psukim was creating targum. Everything that for us is hallowed, you know, tradition, in those days was popping fresh and creative. And they were obviously, because, and we see the use of the midrash and the expansion, they were obviously cross-pollinating. So, you know, in the Targumim, you also have midrashic themes being worked. This was an incredible time. But how do you think they felt about it? They probably weren't as excited as I am. You know why? Because they were only a few hundred years removed from the prophets of Israel. And they're thinking back, well, it's all very nice that we have all of this brilliant creativity. But God stopped talking to us. We don't have anyone telling us what our lives mean. We have to fashion our roadmap out of the old words and the old stories that are left to us from a time when there were prophets directing. And so you see the result? You see the result in the kinos? The very fact that our kina is superimposed on the structure of a Psalm of David, the very fact that so many of the kinos follow patterns from the book of Echa, from the words that Jeremiah spoke when he made sense or made sorrow out of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, it shows how deeply they felt a sense of of loss. Of loss and of being lost. And so this verse, Ososenu lo ro'inu ein od navi, we no longer see signs that tell us what our lives mean, because there are no prophets. V'lo itonu yodea adma, and the place where this loss is most keenly felt is in the question of time. It's like time has lost all of its muscle tone. Time has atrophied and become flabby. It passes, but nothing seems to happen in terms of moving us toward a goal, toward a destiny. And the fact that, as I mentioned before, I'm just sort of pulling the themes together so you can see how they intersect. The fact that Kalir barely, once in a while you catch him, I'm going to suggest one line, one stray line tonight that maybe has a slight contemporary allusion in it. But even that, I'm telling you, I'm pushing it hard. The fact that his poetry has this clean, austere detachment from his own specific circumstances, that it is all in the language of an almost platonic sense of churban, is because his own time doesn't feel worthy to him. There was a young man who was talking to me the other day, a very, very serious young rabbi, who was reading the sermons that Rabbi Lamb, he should be well, that Rabbi Lamb delivered in the 60s and 70s. You know, and he's got sermons about space travel and the first sermons that spoke about, homosexuality as something discussed in the public arena. These sermons, the Shabbosos, they were given. The Jewish center must have been filled with electricity. There was this sense of this brilliant, young, scholarly rabbi who was casting his net in the news of the day and melding it with the lessons of the Torah. 50 years later, that's just so laborious. It's like old newspaper. It just feels very contemporary to another time. Kalir is completely free of that. Kalir, it is impossible to say that it was spoken 1,300 years ago, or 500 years ago, or yesterday. It maintains its extraordinary relevance precisely because at no point did it ever try to be contemporary. So, that's my opinion. You may not agree with it, but that's what makes horse racing. Let's take a look. I would like to work through some of these very interesting paragraphs with you. Now, we've actually done a few of them. Take a look with me, if you wouldn't mind. Here we go to the next very exciting part of my work here. Turn to page 2. We're in the gray, in the black print. Here you have these are each of these psukim, each of these verses forms the foundation of one of Kalir's verses, and each one at some point features the word ko, right? And so this is where you see his expansion, because the midrash that we read, the first one, features two kos, Avraham's the Bris Ben Habsarim, which indeed appears here, we did it last week, and the second one is the giving of the Torah. Right? And of course the third is Birkas Kohanim. They'll all get here, but you notice we have 12 verses, not 3. So the other 9 are all original Midrash, as it were, all based on the same theory. Well, if your Ko is good, I got another couple Ko's that you might like to take a look at. But they are, in each in their way, they require a leap of creativity. The question is where to really, really begin. Let's start with the third one. I don't want to miss some of the later ones, so we'll go a little quickly. This is a very interesting one. Now, this will take a look at the third verse on your sources, Bereishis Lamed Aleph Pasuk Ches, right? It says, Im ko yomar nikudim yesicharecho, v'yoldu kol hatzon nikudim. V'im ko yomar akudim yesicharecho, yoldu kol hatzon akudim. This is where God says that he promises Jacob in a dream. Now remember, this dream is also the same dream in which he promises him it's time to go home to your father's house. So here is Yaakov Avinu about to be engaged in the most important business deal of his life. His children have been born, and he's staying for a little while longer with Lavan in order to build up his own fortunes. And God comes to him in a dream and says, first we're going to make you a little money, then you're going to go home. And he says, the ko here is, if Lavan will say this, then I will change nature to make that the result. And as the speckled and the spotted, if he'll tell you one, that's the way they'll be born. And if he changes and he tells you another, then that will be the way it will be born. What is this? The majesty of this example is that the ko is something which the Almighty says he is willing to introduce even to the experience of the people Israel in the most challenging circumstances of their wandering. That he will send them to the Galut, right? Lavan is Galus. He will send them to Lavan, and co-spoken from the mouth of the trickster will be mobilized by God in their favor. But then the end of this is always moves back in the other direction, because Vehein Ata, we who were once the people, that even when Lavan said the word Ko, we prospered and moved, that's a very important element, moved toward our return to Eretz Yisrael. Oh, look what happened now. Hein ato vikachto ir maleo tishuos. You have brought chastisement to a city which was filled with tumult. Harima po'amecho limashaos. Now here you have the verse. It's a very interesting verse from the pasuk. And you'll find it the beginning of verse 3. Lift up your steps because of the perpetual ruins. Because here is the reaction, and the impact is on God Himself. Once upon a time, God was prepared to enter the speech of our enemies and turn it in our favor. And now God, in His own city, Jerusalem, has to lift his feet to avoid stepping on the broken holiness that has befallen us. And you're going to see that one of the themes of this loss of Ko is that what the arrow that once upon a time brought heaven to earth
Ko yieh, remember the heaven to earth, the first one, ko yieh zaracha. What you see in the heavens will come into your world. Your children will be those stars. And now, it's as if the suffering of the earth reaches up and touches even heaven. That even the Ribbono Shel Olam, who in that verse which was artfully left out, the one which speaks about Har Tzion Ze Shachanta Bo, where you once dwelt in serenity, now you have to lift up your skirts and watch your step, because everything is in ruins. What is more? What could be a more shattering image than HaKadosh Baruch Hu? You ever been in the kitchen and getting a glass of water, and you were a klutz, and you break a glass, and you're in your bare feet, and you can't walk in your own kitchen for fear that you'll cut yourself? I believe that is the image that the psalmist is putting, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself is kivayochol barefoot and vulnerable in the ruined holiness of Jerusalem. Right? So you see the flip. Let's try another one. Maybe somebody would like to jump in and help me with this, because it's very interesting. Ekozam the Harag Mitzri. Now, as soon as we say Harag Mitzri, who killed an Egyptian, right? We're on the fourth couplet, right? Whom are we speaking of? Moshe, good. And Moshe when he kills the Egyptian. But Moshe never can, everybody here wears a petticoat of midrash. You can't get in here without your midrash, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. And he says, Bigan. Now, first of all, the word zam. Every once in a while, I will take the liberty of pointing out to you classic piyut technique, so that you will, because you'll begin to be able to do this yourself, because we have so many adventures to share on this in this field. Zam, very often, Kalir will take a three-letter verb and he will chop off one of the words of the Shoresh and shorten it. So this is from the word zamam, as in edim zomamim, which means plotting.
Zima. No, it's la roots ritsa la shuv shiva. Maybe it's hypothetical azum. Zima.
Well, zima is a whole different theme, because zima means
malice,
or really even something even a little more unseemly than that. So it's hard to say that Moshe is how to bring zima into the notion of Moshe Rabbeinu's consideration. The Mefarshim say it's from zamam, the classic midrash Mefarshim. But it's an interesting, if you can figure out a way to connect it, Jeffrey, I will listen to it, because I got a few chidushim here of my own that I'm going to try out on you. So he says, why would they pick this verb, zom, zomam? Usually you speak of edim zomamim, of the witnesses who conspire to testify against someone when they weren't even there. So what's the zom? Zom is understood to mean a kind of deeply considered action. Something really plotted. See, he didn't just, it wasn't impulse. The Harag, he killed the Mitzri. And what was the context? Bigan Na'ul Bakodesh. Now, Gan Na'ul is a phrase borrowed from the Song of Songs. And it is a phrase which refers to the Jewish people. The Jewish people are called a locked garden, a secret garden. Why are they called Gan Na'ul? And this is particularly relevant to Egypt. Because they observe a standard of morality and chastity, right? Because one of the things that the Jewish people in Egypt were distinguished for was that, unlike the Egyptians, they were moral and chaste. And so it was in, and this is what we call a kinoi. Now you will learn this word. This is the root of the word kinwa, is kinoi. That South American thing was had another name, but we forgot it, and we called it quinoa. And they couldn't pronounce it, they called it quinoa. Trying to make it French and fancy. I made that up completely. Don't put that in your notes, because people will know about it, and it will be embarrassing, and I'll have to publish a public retraction. Anyway, I did not mean that. The kinoi means a euphemistic expression. And it doesn't mean euphemism in the sense that you couldn't say it. It means a way of talking about something with a description of it where you don't... So instead of saying B'nai Yisrael, one of the famous kinuyim, a way of referring to them is that sealed garden. The work... Piyut in general and Kalir specifically are flooded with kinuyim. And you learn to do the translation, you know, in your head to understand what they mean, but they're never chosen casually. In this case, Gan Na'ul means when Moshe killed the Egyptian, he was relying on the fact that no one would report him to Pharaoh. The Gan Na'ul is the secret garden, the place where he felt safe to express his loyalty to his brethren, because he could assume that his brethren would be loyal to him. Now this, of course, was upset with Dothan and Aviram, who threatened, who broke, so to speak, who shattered the sealed garden, and eventually slandered him to Pharaoh. And then the word Bakodesh is interesting. There's a whole lot of stuff, you know, you read the translations. Problem with translation is they sound so darn confident that you don't realize that there have been wars over how to understand it. So one possibility is that the word Bakodesh actually is connected to the word the harag. Harag Mitzri Bakodesh. How would you kill an Egyptian Bakodesh? Well, if you know the Midrash that Moshe used the ineffable name of God, as that was what he did to the Egyptian, that he mentioned the ineffable name of God and that struck him dead, so then Bakodesh makes sense. Or it could be a modifier that it was a Gan Na'ul Bakodesh. It was a garden sealed with holiness. That it was the essential sanctity of the Jewish people which made their community coherent and closed in that way.
Kadosh also said something just separate. Gan also comes in English, and in English comes with an effect.
That what does, I'm sorry?
Gan comes from a word.
Hagain, like magain.
You know, to guard.
Very good, good.
And kadosh just means separate.
Gan.
But here I think it's kadosh as holiness.
All good. I like the Gan, because Gan actually from Magain is would fit into. I mean, he would be capable of doing that, of playing like that. Vayifen kovacho chosam edus kodesh, and he turned right. Now that is a direct quote, because that's where we get in the verse, right? The fourth verse. Vayifen kovacho vayar ki ein ish, and he turned back and forth. He looked here and there, and he saw there was no man. Vayachas amitri vayit minehu bachol, and he buried him in the sand. Right? Now he's assuming you know that. He's also assuming that you might know the Midrash which says, Vayifen kovacho, and this goes back to Zam, he looked into the future and first asked himself, is there any worthy descendant who is destined to come from this Egyptian? Because if there is, I'm not going to kill him. Because we have always the awareness that acts that we commit have long-term implications. And that to kill a human being is essentially, to kill a human being is to cut off a whole line of their descendants. Which is one of the reasons that I tell everybody you have to be nice to Jews. Because even if you see people sitting, for example, in a shul, and you think, well, that's not a very important person, that's not a very nice person, every Jew is the string of a very holy kite. Because somewhere above them, there are the ancestors from whom they came. And they may not seem to be much as individuals, but there's things above them. But what is more, they are also, sometimes it goes the other way, they are the people who are going to be the ancestors of people who are going to make a great deal of difference. So, Chosam Edus Kodesh is very interest is mysterious. The Mefarshim throw up their hands. I believe that what it may be reflecting is the fact, the Midrash, that Moshe was born circumcised. And so he is sealed, or he carries the sign of, because that's the oath, Edus Kodesh, testimony of holiness, that his kind of intrinsic nature. And then he goes, V'hein ato chelkom ochal chodesh, that everything that was theirs was eaten up in a month. That whereas before, you have this careful deliberation, care in doing things that will have effect in history, and our entire history came crashing down during that month of Av. In other words, as opposed to a precise process, we have a kind of a catastrophe which is like a horrible crime committed with a dull knife. It's just ugly. It's a gaping wound. It's not, and it doesn't, we don't know where to start to be able to heal it. Let me do one more.
Can't it be referring back to Zaman, Edim Zolomim, and then you have Edut.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the Zaman that is false, and then
Edus
contrasted code. With the Edut, with the Edut Kodesh, which is
nice. I hear that. I think that's good. Let me get one more minute in. Take a look at the last verse. They're such good things. You should go home and work on each of them. The Bilam thing is wonderful. But the last verse, verse 12, on the other side of the sheet. And there he says, Eko Tishuas Asomai Otsar. And here, the verse which is generally understood as the Genesis verse is from the prophet Zechariah. And he says, Lachein ko amar Hashem, shavti lirushalayim berachamim, beisi yiboneba. There is one more ko waiting for history to fulfill it. And thus says God, I have dwelt, I will return to Jerusalem in mercy. My house shall be rebuilt, Neum Hashem Tzevokos. Kavav Kav Yinate Al Yerushalayim. It's two things, and I don't know the last phrase. Something shall be spread over Jerusalem. But in short, there is one remaining ko. Remember that the whole poem has been about these experiences where ko was in our past, whether it's with Abraham, whether it's with Moshe, whether it's with Yaakov, whether it's at Yericho. Ko reminds us of what we were and what we no longer are. The prophet Zechariah says, Ko lochein ko amar Hashem, shavti Yerushalayim barachim beis yiboneba, I will return to Jerusalem. I will restore the tautness, the sense of direction, the sense of destiny. I will restore it to Jewish history. V'hein atatufchu perochai b'chatzer, my young flowers, which usually refers to pirchei kahuna, at the moment they are swelling corpses in the courtyard. Ad mosa elokim yechoref tzar. And how long will the enemy heap indignity upon us? And the answer is, ad ko, until the time when ko will be restored. And the fact that the Pirchei Kahuna are spoken about as buds means that there will be a flowering and we'll get it back together.